The Guardian.
Has Boris Johnson's Brexit deal come back from the dead? I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly. Since the negotiations in Brussels resumed in earnest on Monday, we've been oscillating between those trusty journalistic standbys, hopes raised and hopes fade, sometimes within minutes of each other. As we record, it still seems just about possible Boris Johnson may have something to present to MPs this weekend in a rare Saturday sitting of the House of Commons. If he does manage to secure a deal, it will be because he's moved significantly towards a Northern Ireland-only backstop, something Theresa May last year said no Prime Minister could accept. Eurosceptics like Jacob Rees-Mogg and Steve Baker seem to be keen to vote for a deal, and Boris Johnson has spent many hours closeted with the DUP's Arlene Foster in the hope of winning her over. So are we finally seeing light at the end of the Brexit tunnel, or is it just temporary optimism with just weeks to go before the 31st of October deadline? Also this week, Kate Proctor reports about the SNP's renewed confidence that they can secure a second independence vote amid the Brexit chaos. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Boris Johnson's crack negotiators went to Brussels at the start of the week for one last push. By lunchtime on Wednesday, it looked as if the UK government had been flexible enough to convince the EU they were ready to make a Brexit deal. But will Johnson's flexibility get him in trouble at home? If a deal was passed in the House of Commons on Saturday, where will that leave us with a general election looming? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by Katie Heywood of Queen's University in Belfast, Torsten Bell of the think tank Resolution Foundation, and James McGrory of the People's Vote Campaign. So, Katie, we seem to have edged quite close, insofar as we all know what's in this agreement that's being discussed, to a Northern Ireland-only backstop. Now, remind us, this was something that was vehemently rejected by Theresa May, wasn't it, in about a year or so ago?
Yes, so the phrase that's constantly been coming forward from the EU very early on has been the idea of being flexible and imaginative in relation to Northern Ireland. So if you remember the joint report in December 2017, which was initially scuppered by Arlene Foster, worried that there wasn't enough about the British closeness to Northern Ireland in that. This went forward into the idea of being flexible and imaginative around Northern Ireland, and then we saw the initial proposals coming forward from the EU early 2018. And this was about something different for Northern Ireland, something specific for Northern Ireland, to avoid having a regulatory and a customs border across the island of Ireland and disrupting the Good Friday Agreement. And this was absolutely, as you say, rejected quite vehemently by Theresa May. And interestingly, she talked about it being a threat to the constitutional integrity of the United Kingdom. And that's a phrase that reflects very much, I think, the close relationship between the DUP and the Conservative Party.
And is your sense that where we're going to end up is going to be fairly close to that, albeit with some sort of wrappings around it, no doubt, to make it look different?
I think for some time in Northern Ireland in particular, talking with businesses and officials and others, I think it's been difficult to conceive of a landing point that hasn't involved Northern Ireland-specific arrangements. And this is really partly because what Theresa May then negotiated after rejecting the Northern Ireland-only backstop was something that was really very much there to reassure the DUP, i.e. it put Britain, the UK as a whole, in a close customs relationship with the EU, albeit on a temporary basis. That, of course, raised the ire of Brexiteers, and we had that sort of unholy coalition, if you like, between sort of very strong unionists and very pro-leave MPs, which saw the defeat of Theresa May's agreement. And so the speculation from our point of view in Northern Ireland has been, well, how do we get around that? Will it end up with a Northern Ireland-specific arrangement? And sure enough, we seem to be heading in that direction. The big question, of course, still remains the DUP. Can they sign up to it? We've seen quite a bit of movement from the DUP over the last few weeks. I wouldn't say they've been preparing the ground, really, amongst unionists here quite enough, perhaps, for the compromise it's entailed, but they've certainly been moving. They will have to make a gigantic leap, I think, if they're going to come forward and support what is very clearly a Northern Ireland-specific arrangement.
And Torsten, what do we know about the economics of this potential deal? How different would it be for the economy than Theresa May's deal, do we think?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, before we get dragged into the glamour of the economics, but on the politics,
It is true that Theresa May said no Prime Minister would sign up to a Northern Ireland backstop, of course.
Repeatedly, yeah.
Although she only said that because, although getting that Northern Ireland backstop was her position before she said that, and the only reason she then said that was because it was clear she wasn't going to get DUP votes. And if there had been a Conservative majority under Theresa May or under Boris Johnson, we'd have had a Northern Ireland only backstop donkeys years
ago.
Yeah. So let's just be clear about how strong the approach to unionism really is in the Conservative Party. What is interesting in some ways is that the DUP are even considering this as an option today. And I think that's where the question comes, what are they getting that they wouldn't have got from the Theresa May deal? And the answer is basically a change consent process and a fig leaf on customs rebates. So a pretense that you can be inside the UK customs union while being in practice in the EU's customs union. But really what they're getting is a better story about consent for Northern Ireland rather than the kind of slightly bald, you're just going to have all EU regulations forever on lots of your market. So that's the real change that they're getting. On the economics, the big change today from Theresa May's actual deal, the one she actually said she wanted to happen, is that it's heading for a much harder Brexit, and mainly for the Great Britain itself. So her deal was basically setting us on the track for the softest Brexit you can have while ending freedom of movement. So in the end, her deal, the simplest way to think about it is, I've got to end freedom of movement. Other than that, I want a low economic cost, and I want as close a relationship as I can get, and I want an easy as I can. I want a reduced risk of problems between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. This approach is, I want to solve the Northern Ireland problem, but by basically hiving off Northern Ireland. And other than that, I want to say to the ERG, to the hardline Brexiteers, what they are getting out of this deal, even though they don't like them, some aspects of the Northern Ireland element of it, is that the end state is a free trade agreement with very minimal common standards accepted. So not a very close free trade agreement, but a free trade agreement at the end of the day. And that's a less close relationship. Serious studies of that would show it having a larger hit on our economy in the long run. But people arguing from the other side would say it builds in much more autonomy. So you're basically getting more sovereignty on both customs and on goods regulations and wider regulations, and you're getting that at a price of probably a smaller economy.
Just to pick up on, Torsten used the phrase of hiving off Northern Ireland, which is perfectly understandable, and I think that is the kind of sentiment that's possibly growing amongst pro-Brexit MPs. But of course, that's exactly the kind of notion that makes unionists feel very anxious and more inclined to sort of dig their heels in. And the question of consent and how that's managed is an interesting one, because it really wasn't there when Arlene Foster was originally objecting to the joint report and the Northern Ireland only backstop. It's only really come to the fore around the backstop itself in January or so. And I think they will be looking for a way in consent to be able to veto, which of course isn't really what consent is about at all. And the DUP, how they would be viewed here is possibly of having missed their chance, and they'd be criticised from unionist quarters as well as others in Northern Ireland for kind of having missed that perfect leave scenario that May kind of lined up, which was a softer Brexit, ultimately, which is really for the benefit probably of the union as a whole in the longer term.
That's interesting. So you think they might pay it? Because one of the questions presumably the DUP are asking themselves is, what would be the electoral costs and benefits of accepting Johnson's deal? You think they might be blamed for not going for Theresa May's deal, ultimately?
Yes, it's hard to know, because as with all of these things, when people talk about the backstop, so much of it really wasn't actually about the backstop. And unionist objections to the backstop really were primarily centred on, where does this leave Northern Ireland within the union? Not really about, you know, what it actually means for Northern Ireland to follow certain EU regulations, etc. That's the sphere in which unionism manages all of this, and it's notable that there is quite a lot of criticism of the DUP coming into this if it looks as though, you know, Johnson, if it looks like he will betray the DUP, then yes, they will surely be criticised for that here, and they will pay an electoral cost, not least because there will be direct consequences for the economy in Northern Ireland.
How realistic is it, Katie, do you think, to have checks but without them impeding people's daily lives and sort of losing that sense that the border is sort of not there?
I mean, ultimately Brexit will mean harder borders all around Northern Ireland and friction all around Northern Ireland, which will bring its own problems. Fundamentally, checks on goods coming across the Irish Sea is simply much easier to manage and much less intrusive into daily life and the economy than checks across the Irish border, given the different nature of those borders. But there will be consequences and people will be alert to fundamentally the symbolism of it all. I think it'll come down to language and terminology. So the DP are being quite clear about, you know, the UK as a whole being outside of the customs union and single market and Northern Ireland being in the customs territory of the UK. But given the lack of detail and understanding about what that actually means in practical terms, I think they think there's quite a lot of stretch in that. Maybe they're hoping it will be enough cover if they can then bring forward possibly, you know, a nice investment package and something about consent. But I'm not sure if they think, especially if the language is sort of geared up in Westminster about, you know, dumping Northern Ireland as a problem, then they will be on high alert and they will sort of revert back to a sort of defensive stance, I would imagine.
Yeah, there were certainly reported comments by Dominic Cummings, weren't there, earlier in the summer, that he didn't mind if Northern Ireland fell into the sea, which I'm not sure is quite the government's public stance. But anyway, James, it is going to be Super Saturday for you, isn't it?
Oh, very much. I hope so. The People's Vote have got our latest big demonstration, a march from Park Lane to Parliament Square, and couldn't have been timed better. So fingers crossed, a bit of luck with the English weather in mid-October, and hopefully we'll have hundreds of thousands of people outside on the streets demanding that they get the final say on Brexit rather than a group of 650 people in the building opposite in Parliament on Saturday.
And is that your hope that it will influence a bit the thoughts of those MPs who've got to make quite a big decision potentially on Saturday?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we hear a lot, quite understandably, about how we live in a divided country and that there are lots of people who, if we don't Brexit, we'll be very angry indeed. And I don't dispute that. But we hear much less that there will be people who think that the Brexit that was promised in 2016 bears absolutely no... it's nothing like the one that's being delivered. No one was talking about a border in the Irish Sea, about hiving off Northern Ireland to have completely different arrangements from the rest of the country. And that's before you get into divorce bills, money for the NHS, trade deals ready on day one, exact same benefits as single market membership, none of which have delivered. In fact, there's barely a vote leave promise. And people will be rightly angry that 3 years later, they haven't had a say. And in fact, what it looks like is it may be decided by backroom dealings with small groups of MPs, whether they're from the DUP, whether they're from the so-called Spartan rebels in the Conservative Party or elsewhere. That does not seem to me, or indeed I think anybody on the march on Saturday, to be the democratic solution to what is probably the biggest decision we'll take as a nation in my lifetime.
And it sounds as though there are going to be some efforts on Saturday to somehow attach a people's vote, attach a referendum to a Johnson deal, even if it goes through Parliament on Saturdays. Is that the right thing, you think, that this, even if this passes Parliament, this deal should now go back to the public?
Definitely. I mean, the exact mechanics of how that happens slightly depends on whether they're presented with a deal, whether it's an actual legal text, whether that's Saturday, whether that's Monday for later in the week, whether it's after a summit.
Yeah, we should say Super Saturday might not. There may not even be a sitting if there's nothing to discuss. Yeah.
But I think the basic principle, which more and more MPs are coming round to, some of them enthusiastically, some of them a bit more reluctantly, it has to be said, is this idea of a confirmatory ballot. Well, this is an actual Brexit deal. Now, I don't think very much of it. I think it's a very, very hard version of Brexit. I think it's sort of Canada minus. I don't think it was anything like what was promised in 2016. But surely we should ask the people themselves, this is actually what Brexit means. Do you want it? That seems to me to be a very, very simple way of sorting out what has been an extraordinary issue for our country that has enveloped us in debate, that has divided our nation. Will ask the people, do they want this or not? Don't just ask the DUP. That does not seem to me to be a democratic solution that's going to affect every person, family and community in this country for decades.
Later on in the show, we'll look at Sajid Javid's announcement that he's going to hold a budget in November, seen by many as the start of the Tory election campaign. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, it's difficult to take positives from the continuing chaos of Brexit, but the Scottish National Party, however, has found a way. Its leader, Nicola Sturgeon, said she will request another independence referendum from the Prime Minister in a matter of weeks. The plan is for Scottish people to have a vote as early as next year. Sturgeon was talking at the party's autumn conference in Aberdeen, which took place last weekend. So what do other SNP members think of the prospect of IndyRef 2? Will the Prime Minister even allow it? And how has this week's stark judgment in Catalonia influenced the Scots? The Guardian's political correspondent Kate Proctor reports.
Well, I think the mood at the SNP conference was pretty enthusiastic, quite fired up. The last time I went was 3 years ago, and it felt really similar. And it's because they have this renewed sense that independence is possible and that they think they now are at a stage where they can go back to the UK government and ask for an independence referendum to be held by requesting something technical. It's called Section 30. But that was the big talk is, you know, we're going to put Section 30 in within a matter of weeks. Nicola Sturgeon said that. And other MPs that I spoke to whilst I was there just seemed very fired up and enthusiastic that they think because of Brexit, it really gives them a very strong case to go again with an independence referendum. So the conference started with a very positive poll, which had support for independence on about 50%. However, when you speak to people, they're saying it really needs to be a bit higher than that for them to have real confidence that they could put it over the line. And I don't think that it's been higher than 55%. Ever before. So I think I was hearing a lot of positive noises about the fact there'll be a referendum. They think that's possible, but I didn't hear quite so much conviction about the stage beyond that when you actually have to go to the polls and get people there. I did hear an interesting thing though, is that the EU apparently are very keen on Scotland to go again. And this is from, not from the EU Commission, but this is from EU politicians. So a Scottish MEP, an SNP member of the European Parliament. He says all those conversations that you hear in Europe are just, when are you going to go for it again? When's it going to happen again, you know? Just get it done. In Catalonia, there was a big push for independence, and that was conducted through a referendum, which was actually deemed illegal by the Spanish government. So although thousands and thousands of people took part in it, the result of the referendum wasn't realised, and those politicians that organised that were jailed for essentially trying to break Catalan away from Spain. It did form quite an interesting backdrop for the SNP, because someone who is Scottish and also Catalan addressed the conference in the afternoon and gave a very, very emotional speech about how those jail sentences for some of those Catalan politicians, which reach about 12 or 13 years, think they're very disproportionate, very harsh, and sends out a very, very negative message in terms of people's right to self-determination. So there's solidarity there between Catalan and Scotland, something that I hadn't appreciated before I went to the SNP conference.
So we've heard a lot so far about whether there is a plan B.
And there is an argument going on within the SNP at the moment as to whether you go for an independence referendum and declare it yourself. And you would do that by, let's say, having a majority of seats at the next general election. You'd be able to show that the SNP is so popular and have a mandate to just call a referendum. But that's not the legal process. That isn't the gold standard that is so often referred to by Nicola Sturgeon of a legal and due process where the British government would accept it and the European Union would accept it. So how you achieve this independence referendum is definitely was a big talking point at the conference. But at the end of the day, the people that want to do it legally through normal legislative means, similar to the one that happened last time where you request this Section 30 order, that was the group that won out. And that's the group that's led by Nicola Sturgeon, who's First Minister.
It's a legally agreed constitutional legal process in full transparency of the international community and the people of Scotland. And that's how we'll do it again. There is no question we'll don't go for any other route. There
are some folks. I spoke to Alan Smith. He's an SNP member of the European Parliament, and he's absolutely adamant that it has to be done that way so that people respect it, take it seriously, and it gives the best possible chance of, let's say, the result is independence this time, that it is completely recognised by UK and international law.
I don't see any grounds, and the mainstream of the party, the vast majority of the party, doesn't see any reasons to be changing our view on how to do that. I think we'd lose Middle Scotland, I think we'd lose international support. I think it's coming from a good place. An SNP conference is a place to debate. It was David Hume that said the truth emerges from an honest disagreement amongst friends. The right to bring stuff forward, the right to try and vent their frustration, but our policy is sound for where it is. But there's a lot of frustration in Scotland, and the UK government should be very aware of that.
So there's the feeling that Theresa May was a staunch unionist and that Boris Johnson isn't quite so passionate in that respect politically. However, the Conservative Party is the Conservative and Unionist Party, that's in their title, and so it's very likely that they will turn it down. They don't want to see the breakup of the union, and we hear this back and forth all the time in Parliament. Ian Blackford will talk about independence and Boris Johnson will hit it straight back and say that it's not happening. However, I did hear only at fringe events on the sidelines of the conference that if that is the case, there are lots and lots of people who would want there to be a legal challenge. There are a lot of MPs who think it's democratically correct that the British government allows Scotland to have a second referendum. However, there is this group that seems to be growing which thinks that if it is turned down, they can mount a legal challenge and they would possibly be successful in that.
I think they have to veto it because there is a growing movement of people in Scotland, and whether they want to vote yes or to vote no in that referendum, they want to have that say again.
SNP MP Alison Thewlis, she just was very, very strong, and I think the language she used was very passionate that Boris Johnson has absolutely no right to turn this request down should he get it.
I think it ought to be quite difficult for him to say no, because as a politician he has changed his mind, he's switched backwards and forwards, he has done all kinds of things that would lead me to say, well, you know what, if he can change his mind, if he can do all these things, why doesn't he give Scotland the right to change its mind as well?
The biggest take from SNP conference is that they are so ready for this second independence referendum. They're really fired up, they're really animated, and this Section 30 request is going to go in very soon.
We need more powers to protect our citizens, to grow our economy, to build a wealthier nation. We need the powers to deliver lasting change. Conference, Scotland needs independence.
That was Ian Blackford there speaking at the SNP conference, and thanks to Kate Proctor for that piece.
My government's priority has always been to secure the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of October.
Now, it might seem like an age ago after three hectic days, but on Monday, the government announced a proposed legislative programme in what many said was an atypical Queen's speech. To mark the new session of Parliament, the Queen read out a summary of the new laws planned to be implemented by a Tory government that doesn't have a majority. But before the speech even took place, the Chancellor Sajid Javid announced plans for a budget on 6th of November, days after what the government insists will be the 31st of October Brexit date. Torsten, usually the announcement of a budget is the sort of thing that gets think tankers like you very excited. But is this just part of the build-up to the general election?
I'm not rising to your slander about what gets people in think tanks excited. It takes a little bit more than that. Maybe not a lot more, but a little bit more than that. I mean, yes, so the government has said that it would like to hold a budget on the 6th of November. That is obviously just after supposed Brexit D-Day. They've said that is what they'll do if there is a Brexit deal. And if there is a Brexit deal, clearly what they're saying is there'll be a budget and then we'll be off to the polls and I shall see you for an early December general election. Obviously what happens if there's an extension is kind of slightly unclear, so we'll have to wait and see. But yes, generally what we're doing here is setting up a general election. That's what the Queen's speech was about this week, and that's what a budget would be for if it takes place on the 6th of November.
And what do we know now about Boris Johnson's programme for government, as it were, whether it turns out to be, you know, short-lived because we're off to a general election or whatever? What do we know about his priorities?
We know what the election he wants to fight is. So the election is get Brexit done, get the criminals and end austerity. And that's what you get if you vote for Boris Johnson. You saw that in September with the spending round, with him announcing significant increases in public service spending, obviously not reversing austerity, reversing about a third of it, but definitely ending it. So all department spending growing next year, overall departmental spending growing by more than it has probably for about 15 years. So a big increase in Spending at the cost of blowing up its fiscal rules. So this is not a government that currently has fiscal rules guiding its overall approach to economic policy in lots of ways. Actually, the Labour Party today has a tougher approach on day-to-day, the fiscal side, than the Conservative Party, i.e. they want to fund it all by tax increases, whereas the Conservative Party has no intention of doing so. In fact, they're promising tax cuts on top of spending increases.
And we should just pause to sort of mark how absolutely extraordinary that is, shouldn't we? What a turnaround that is from when Philip Hammond was Chancellor before the summer. We've got a Tory party that has just ripped up its fiscal rules and thrown them out the window.
Well, it tells you a number of things. I mean, it tells you that it's 10 years since the financial crisis, and that's a very long time. It tells you that, as you already knew, Heather, that politicians pay attention to what the public think, and the public are well and truly through the austerity fatigue boundary. They're into the wanting more spending, not less phase of the political economy cycle, and the Conservative Party is basically recognising that. There's very little extra benefit to be had from telling them that there's more tough times to come, and so that's not what they're going to do. Now, what is the truth? The truth is borrowing is at a 17-year low. The cost of that borrowing is very low. So is it possible to do what they're planning to do, which is to increase borrowing to pay for that spending? Yeah, that is possible. But announcing lots of that before you know what your Brexit deal is, what the size of your economy is, you'll have seen news from the IMF this week about wider global, nothing to do with Brexit, but wider global economic headwinds. Knowing how much more you have got to spend on your public services, which in the end, in the long term, do have to be funded via the taxes you collect, is odd. It's like going to deciding you're going to go to a shop and how much you're going to spend before you know what your wage packet is. And that's a slightly odd approach to take to the fiscal policy. But as I say, the Conservative
Party doesn't seem very prudent, as Gordon Brown used to say.
Which definitely less harsh and like focused on fiscal outcomes. Yes. So this is not a Conservative Party that's now saying what happens to the debt and the deficit is what we're about. What we're about is delivering Brexit, as I said, tough on law and order, because that's what they think the voters who are also they're trying to bring with them on Brexit want, and then taking off the table the big negative, which is if you vote Tory, you get more austerity.
James, you're no stranger to electoral strategy with your...
Or disappointment.
With your old hat on as a Lib Dem advisor. Does that seem like a kind of electoral sweet spot to you that Johnson is now in? You spend more money on schools and hospitals, very tough on law and order.
It's a theoretical electoral sweet spot. If you can persuade the country that you have done Brexit, despite the fact you're about to enter into 10 years of negotiations, that you're going to get tough on law and order, and let's be honest, they've heard that before, and you're also going to be able to spend money on a load of different things that we haven't for ages in a very unconservative-like manner, while you're also dealing with both global economic headwinds and the fallout from a pretty hard version of Brexit. If you can persuade people that's what you're going to do, then that does sound like an electoral sweet spot to me, and you do have an advantage of being more popular than your direct opponent. However, you know, there's a group of people who will, in my opinion, just see through that for what it is, which is yet another set of promises made by Johnson, whether they're on the side of a red bus or not, that are just not going to be delivered. The Conservative Party under Johnson and Cummings are putting together quite an unusual electoral constituency that they're trying to pursue, which is sort of more traditional Conservative voters in the south of England, interested in sovereignty but quite well to do and with rather traditional Conservative values, and then people who are pretty angry about insert what Brexit, immigration, pace of change in their communities across large parts of the, but largely in the north and the Midlands. That is an extraordinarily difficult electoral constituency to keep together over any length of time. You broadly managed to cobble that together in 2016 in very, very unusual circumstances. For a start, it was a referendum rather than a general election. And you might be able to do it for one election, particularly, if other parties don't have a clear offer and don't have popular front figures. But there is no way you can keep that electoral constituency together in the long term. And what I think is interesting is the Conservative Party do seem to have lost a lot of people, sort of small C conservative, particularly in the Midlands and the South, who are pro-business, pro-internationalism, pro-European. And I don't think those people are coming back anytime soon to the Conservative Party. So it's whether they can, these new voters that they think they appealed to in 2016, that they really are competing with, they think the Brexit Party and the Labour Party for now, whether that can offset the people they've definitely lost to the Lib Dems and elsewhere. And I'm not necessarily sure that they are nailed on for a majority, even though it does sound like quite an interesting and desirable pitch.
And how do the Lib Dems play it? If so, we know they stand for not Brexit, pretty clear about that. How do they play it if this deal goes through and we've left the EU?
I mean, I don't know, because they're, at the moment they're able to just set out their stall very, very clearly, which is if they win a majority, revoke and stop Brexit. If they don't, they'll do everything they can to get a referendum. Every sign, every poll you see, everybody you talk to in the party suggests that that is winning with the people they need to win with, who are basically, you know, pro-European. So that's the market they're fishing in. And there's a lot more of them than the 7% or 7.5% of people who voted Lib Dem in 2017. So it's quite a smart electoral strategy. I don't know what they do in the event of a post-Brexit deal election, if you like, because that's not where we're at. But I would be very, very, very surprised if they didn't continue to pursue the group of Remain voters who would look at that deal and think this is a catastrophe for our country and it was nothing like what was promised in 2016 and I don't really want any part of it. And I think the Lib Dems have been smart enough, and Jo Swinson's done a brilliant job on this, frankly, to understand that they are the party of Remain. That's what they're saying, and people can understand it. It's a very simple argument, and they like it by the looks of it.
That's problematic for Labour, though, Torsten, isn't it, with your former hat on, or not with your former hat on, but with your knowledge of how Labour will think about these things, because its voters are on both sides of that, aren't they?
For Labour, it is very hard if a deal has been done, because it will, at the moment, they do have a position that will just about hold through a general election campaign, which is basically, we're kind of Remain-y, and you'll get a vote afterwards, basically.
If you want a referendum, we'll give it to you.
Yeah, exactly, and that's like a kind of position. Afterwards, what the Labour Party would make the Labour Party's life easiest is a deal, a long break, then a general election campaign, by which time Brexit's just done, and they can have a straightforward domestic politics row, and as we've just discussed, that isn't available to them.
No.
And so instead, they get boxed into a kind of probably into a fudge position, which is to basically get a soft Brexit, but is basically Brexit, at which point the Lib Dems are very, very, very happy people.
Katie, tell us how this general election is likely to be framed in Northern Ireland. We talked a bit about the DUP, didn't we, and whether they would be blamed / praised for where we end up.
The DUP will probably be under pressure for at least a couple of seats, as is the case in Britain. A lot depends on how the other parties coordinate, the Remain parties coordinate, and there's a lot of interest in a few seats in that regard. And also, of course, whether the DUP does deals with the Ulster Unionist Party as well. Interestingly, I mean, if we do have the issue of consent coming forward and some kind of Stormont lock, then the DUP will sort of be playing this up, I think, as to the sort of the importance of demonstrating the strength of conviction in the pro-leave and pro-union vote. And inevitably so, it will be an election that will be fought on sort of constitutional grounds, so people being encouraged to vote very clearly for a strong unionist or a strong nationalist position.
It's your sense that... So Julian Smith is evidently throwing himself into trying to get Stormont back up and running, isn't he? Is your sense that that's making any headway?
So I'm not sure how much it's you're sort of aware of it in Britain, but the prospect of reform in relation to abortion and in relation to same-sex marriage is really something that seems to be generating a lot of momentum amongst parties here, vis-a-vis the re-establishment of the Assembly. So
it set a deadline. Parliament effectively set a deadline, didn't it?
By the 21st of October, yeah. And, you know, the key stumbling block for getting Stormont up and running has been primarily the Irish Language Act. And we've been just waiting for so long for that hurdle to be overcome. And, of course, people were trying to wait for certainty on Brexit. But actually, it's this... the prospect of reform in relation to abortion and same-sex marriage being done from Westminster rather than from Stormont that seems to be generating the most political noise at the moment. And Julian Smith has been, he's certainly been more proactive than previous Secretaries of State have been. He seems to be engaging more publicly with a wide range of people, possibly not quite as wide as some people would like to see, but doing things to try and generate to reflect the fact that people are very frustrated about the lack of political representation in Northern Ireland at the moment. It would be quite sad if it was the case that the murder of a journalist didn't lead to the re-establishment of Stormont and people taking their seats, if it was in order to try and prevent reform in relation to equal marriage and abortion that actually got them back in there. That would be quite pitiful, in my personal opinion.
Presumably, if Stormont does get up and running, that helps with the consent piece of the Brexit puzzle.
It does, but again, you can be sure that, yes, that it would be viewed, you know, that the whole debate wouldn't be specifically about, you know, the EU regulations or about customs. It would be about whether Northern Ireland is closer to Ireland or to Britain. So a sort of return to that kind of very crude politics that really doesn't represent the realities of the challenges that Northern Ireland will be, or does face and will be facing very much after Brexit.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Katie Heywood, James McGrory, Torsten Bell and Kate Proctor. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more Brit podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.